Welcome to the Bail in the Midwest podcast, hosted by Shane Rolfe.
Hello and welcome to the Bail in the Midwest podcast, where we explore a variety of topics related to bail, pretrial release, and the criminal justice system in the Midwest. My name is Shane Rolfe. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Kansas Bail Agents Association, and I've worked in this field for the past 35 years. Now, our guest from a couple episodes ago, Jared Fishman, the author of Fire on the Levee, said in his book, and I'll quote, "In the U.S. criminal justice system, prosecutors are the most powerful actors. More than anyone else, they have the power to affect case outcomes, from who is arrested to who is incarcerated and for how long. They have an inordinate amount of power when it comes to determining whether the legal process is fair or not fair." Prosecutors, however, come in all varieties. The hardline law and order types, those like Mr. Fishman, who specialized in prosecuting police officers. And as if we have seen in various cities, so-called progressive prosecutors, which is to say, prosecutors who seem determined not to prosecute certain crimes. So while we have talked a lot about bail reform in this podcast, I thought it would be a good idea to talk about the role of the prosecutor in the criminal justice system. My guest today is well suited to enlighten us. Vanessa Reebley has been practicing law for the past 25 years. 21 of those years were spent as an assistant district attorney in Johnson County, Kansas. In 2016, she was selected as the Kansas Prosecutor of the Year, and she has been on the shortlist of candidates submitted to the governor for possible judicial appointment on three separate occasions. She is currently with Bath & Edmonds, one of the top flight law firms in this area, which focuses on criminal defense, and she is also running for district attorney in the upcoming election in Johnson County, Kansas. Vanessa, welcome to the podcast.
Shane, thank you for that introduction, and it's an honor to be with you here today.
Thank you. So just have I missed any high points in that? I know I kind of just skimmed over your LinkedIn and your Google searches and stuff, and you got that. So what other wonderful things have you done that I failed to mention here?
Well, I was a career prosecutor until 2021, graduated from law school, worked in the Johnson County DA's office 21 years, and then now I'm with Bath & Edmonds, so that's pretty much it.
Well, let's walk through your background just a little bit. Your LinkedIn page said you graduated from Bethel College, which is a small school in Harvey County, Kansas, with a degree in accounting.
Accounting and business administration, yes.
Okay. So I guess first off, you know, our very first guest on the podcast was Stephen Owens, who is a state representative from Harvey County. So how did you end up at Bethel? Was there a family connection? I know it's a religious school or a religious affiliated school.
Well, it's pretty simple. I followed a boy. my boyfriend, I had gone to Dodge City Community College on an athletic scholarship, and I was dating a football player, and he was the quarterback at Bethel. So I visited the campus. I liked the small size, and that's how I got there. And, you know, accounting degrees can be very difficult as you progress through college in the later years, and I loved the small school, and it was just a great atmosphere.
Well, and I know my daughter, when we were looking at colleges for her, you know, she just missed being a national merit semifinalist. And so at that point in time, the University of Oklahoma was offering more or less full ride scholarships. And so we went to visit, you know, OU just on the idea that, hey, they might pay for all this. And she's like, I hate this place. And it's like, oh, okay. Ultimately, she ended up at Washburn, and we'll talk about that a little bit more too as well. But so was the plan always to go to law school? I know a lot of lawyers, more on the civil side of things, business law, they tend to have accounting degrees. Was that the plan when you went there?
Because The plan was always to go to law school, but I grew up in a single parent family. There was not money saved for law school. And frankly, I was the first member of my family to go down that route. So I thought if I could get a degree in accounting and business administration, I could work for a few years, earn enough money to help me get into law school. That was a bad plan because when you find out how much law school costs, there's no way to make enough money. But I worked in the accounting field. for a few years, then moved up to the Kansas City metro area, actually worked for Lockton as an accountant, and then applied to law school within a year. And it was similar. I had to decide between Washburn and KU. And Washburn sold me, A, I got a scholarship, a larger scholarship, but B, they had a keg on the outside after our tour. And I thought, okay, this is more me than KU. So.
Well, I don't know about the keg, but my daughter ended up going to Washburn as well, you know, and she just liked the smaller school.
Yes, my son goes there right now. He's a junior at Washburn. He wants to be an attorney, and that was the draw to him, a smaller type school. He graduated from Olathe West here, so, you know, he's used to very large, and I think he wanted smaller classes.
Just trying to think when both my niece and nephew went to Olathe West for a while, but then they moved. He probably would have been ahead of them. So no issue there. So I know a lot of times when we see these professionals, I mean, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, oftentimes people are looking at these professions saying, okay, you know, I'm going to get in this because I need to make some money. You know, I mean, like, particularly if you come from a less than well-off background, it's like, I want to become a professional because I'm not going to work, you know, in a bar or, you know, in some other, you know, I think what Johnny Cochran called it, outside job. You wanted to get an inside job. So what did make you decide to become a lawyer on that? Was it a money driven thing or a calling?
No, if it would have been money driven, I would not have been a prosecutor, but it was a calling. So what I will tell you is I grew up with in a domestic violence household in the 70s in rural Kansas, where, you know, there wasn't a lot of help. So that started my passion to not only help myself, to help my family and help others. So I knew from a very young age that I wanted to work in the criminal justice system to be a voice for people who didn't have a voice, because, you know, growing up like that was difficult at times. And that's why I have such passion in the criminal justice side, whether it is, you know, as a prosecutor or when I'm representing individuals charged with crimes, to make sure, you know, the right outcome occurs.
You sort of stole my next question because I was going to get into that, but that's okay. You know, you do basically fall into the latter, you know, of this is a calling, this is what I want to do, you know, and you know, the background comes into that. So let's sort of get into the role of a prosecutor. In some other countries, the judge is often the driver or investigator of criminal prosecution. You have a judge or a jury. In countries like France, Italy, Spain, the what we call the romance language, you know, countries when I was back in high school taking mm-hmm. language classes, which is to say that those legal systems that were based on Roman law use an inquisitorial system of justice. So if you're charged, you know, with a serious crime in, say, Spain, you really can expect the Spanish Inquisition. So poor joke there, but, you know, for Monty Python fans. But in the United States, we have an adversarial system. Can you kind of give us an overview of the role of the prosecutor in this adversarial system that we use here in the United States?
Well, I absolutely agree that the prosecutor is the most powerful person in the courtroom. And some people may hear that and think, well, no, that's the judge. He pronounces sentence. But the prosecutor decides, you know, what is going to be charged from the very beginning of the case. Now, the prosecutor should not be involved in the investigation, but on larger cases, you're going to have knowledge. And then you decide what's charged. So whether it's a high level or if you go a lower level, that is a huge decision in the criminal case. And then also recommendations on bond. You know, the bond is a very subjective decision, which is between the prosecutor's recommendation and then the judge. And then as you continue through the system, the prosecutor decides, you know, am I going to offer a plea? And what kind of plea am I going to offer? Are we going to go to jury trial? And if we go to jury trial, am I going to file enhancements to increase the sentence? And then ultimately, you know, at sentencing, the prosecutor, you know, whether it's the plea or it's the result of a conviction, decides what to ask for. You know, in our ethical rules, they call us ministers of justice. And that is what the goal should be. Unfortunately, it's not always, but that's what the goal should be. Because, again, I believe that the prosecutor is the most powerful person in that courtroom.
So how far does that power go? You know, what I've loosely referred to is the prosecutor's veto, and we're seeing that more often. One of my major complaints about Kamala Harris when she was the attorney general of the state of California was a bail-related lawsuit where an activist group was suing the state of California, alleging that their bail bond system was unconstitutional. And Kamala Harris, as the attorney general, decided, oh, no, you know, this is politically expedient for me to be on the other side of this issue. So I am, as an attorney general, am not going to defend the statute. And she just simply walked away, you know, and whereas it is, you know, my feeling was always it's the job of the attorney general of any particular state to defend the statutes of those states, whether mm-hmm. you agree with them or not. You're an attorney for the people who passed that law. If the court then says that's no good, then that's the court's decision. Right. But your job as an advocate is to advocate for the legitimacy of the statute, whether you really right. agree with it or not.
Right. Our job is to enforce the laws. And I have long said that I don't think a district attorney's office should be political because, you know, that brings too many other, you know, opinions and biases into the process. But our job is to enforce the law.
Well, and I know a lot of people will say that, but I think if I recall your history correctly, you've actually walked that walk. After Mr. Morrison left to become attorney general and Phil Klein was appointed to replace him as the district attorney, and he did bring a very political mindset in there. Mm-hmm. It seemed like his entire focus was on abortion related issues and all political issues as opposed to criminal justice. Right. I believe that is the stretch of time that you stepped away from the prosecutor's office.
That's correct. I stayed for about 4 months until I could find a job because I just didn't want to quit. I was a single parent. That was not possible. But yes, it was a very political atmosphere. I've told the story before. I was asked as a single mother, you know, what do you make your son for dinner? I was asked my views on abortion. And there were 8 people fired. There were 7 of those were attorneys. And then some of the people that came in to fill those slots, you could tell they were purely political appointments. Like I had to explain to an attorney that I was training the difference between reasonable suspicion, probable cause, you know, all of that type of information. So yes, I left because I was not going to work in that type of political atmosphere. When I worked for Morrison, you know, I think there was a point where I didn't know if he was a Republican or a Democrat. And I think that's how it should be.
Well, I mean, if one could argue that he didn't know that either, considering how he ran in those various
Fair
races.
Point. Fair point.
How far does prosecutorial discretion extend? I mean, does it extend to just individual cases or entire categories of crime? Because that seems to be kind of a hot button issue now. I mean, you think, okay, I'm going to decide this particular case. Should I charge this individual or should I decide I'm not going to charge this type of crime at all?
So I think it's a case by case basis. I don't think that you can just categorically say, I'm not going to charge this. On one of your podcasts, you know, I heard them talk, you guys, there was a discussion about not charging misdemeanors.
Right.
What automatically popped up to me was, well, you're going to eliminate thousands of domestic violence cases being charged per year. So what happens to, you know, those victims? What happens to the children in those households? So I think that you should not categorically say, I'm not going to prosecute this. I think it's a case by case basis.
Okay. Well, no, I agree. I think that, I mean, we watched Ron DeSantis remove a couple of prosecutors in Florida who made these blanket assertions that we're not going to charge these crimes. And he's like, well, then you're not going to be the district attorney because that's your job. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was politically motivated from the governor's office on those. But still, if you're not going to enforce the law or you're going to sit there and say, I'm going to overrule the legislature and the people and the government and every other branch of government, you know, aspect of government that's determined this should be illegal, should you really be the person enforcing those laws? So we'll talk about progressive prosecutors in a minute here. But so how do the administrative choices, the discretionary choices that the prosecutor makes, how do they impact the community as a whole?
Well, I mean, it depends. So, you know, Johnson County is unique because we have so many different levels of law enforcement or so many different cities of law enforcement. So you get all types of cases that are sent. So really, the district attorney needs to have a policy in place. You may charge a particular crime, but your plea guidelines may be such that they may not be as strict. For instance, possession of marijuana cases, you know, that's all over the board right now with the different jurisdictions in Kansas. Possession of marijuana is still, it is not legal in Kansas. What's interesting is if you get stopped with marijuana in a city, you get a ticket. If you get stopped by Johnson County, you go to jail. So, you know, decisions have to be made that you have to enforce the law, but then the question becomes, how does that affect the community? Just like with domestic violence cases, you know, there's a probable cause standard that it's a mandatory arrest if the officer has probable cause. So, you know, those are cases that are handled at the district court level. Some jurisdictions push those down to municipal court, but it's important to have a unified policy on that because there has to be equitable treatment with cases. And that's why I brought up the marijuana, because it's not equitable treatment, city court versus district court. And that can lead to issues, you know, with different community members. Like, why is my son incarcerated for 2 days because he was stopped on a highway versus his friend who, you know, just got a ticket? I don't think that really answers your question, but.
but it is another topic of interest, because I, you know, I'm the legislative chair for the Kansas Bail Agents Association. So I follow the stuff legislatively. And I know that Sheriff Hayden, the last couple years, had been pushing a bill that would allow Sheriff's Office and the Highway Patrol to issue notices to appear, which is essentially that short form citation for a marijuana offense that the city courts can do now, but that the county courts, you know, the district court cannot. And for people that aren't familiar with Kansas, you know, the Sheriff's Office and the Highway Patrol, those arrests would funnel into district court, just as whereas if you're arrested by a city police, you know, officer, it's going to probably be funneled through municipal court, depending on the severity of the charge, because those municipal court arrests could be, you know, focused up to the district attorney's office, depending on the severity, depending on the policy of the district attorney's office, like, for instance, domestic violence. You did point out something about Johns County, and I'm probably monologuing here a little bit, but Johns County is one of the few districts that actually has that uniform control that all domestic violence cases are charged at the district court level. So there is that continuity. So whereas, you know, in Kansas City, Kansas, just north, the county just north of us, they have sort of a family court, but it's all done through municipal court. And, you know, you might not spend any time in jail at all or a couple hours and you're back out again, you know, and you don't have that separation. And so you get these repeat offenses. Let's jump ahead here. What, you know, we hear this term progressive prosecutor, Soros prosecutor. So how I've got my own definition of that, but how do you define the progressive prosecutor? Because, you know, there's some support for that line of thinking.
Right. You know, my observations would be those are more blanket policies on different types of crimes, different individuals. Whereas my position as a prosecutor is it is more of a case by case, county by county type evaluation. You know, to make a blanket statement that we're not going to prosecute misdemeanors or that we're not going to prosecute property offenses, you know, that's not how the criminal justice system works. You know, you can have somebody that commits a misdemeanor domestic violence, like I said, and if you're not going to prosecute misdemeanors, what happens to that victim? And then what happens to those children? And same with, you know, property crimes. The issue like Oak Park Mall type situations where we have individuals traveling across the country committing organized retail crime. That's a lot different than a young kid shoplifting like a couple $100 worth of something. When you have career criminals that may have extensive violent crime convictions. So when you just make a blanket, we're not going to prosecute X or Y, I think that can hurt your community. You need to understand, you know, that the crime statistics in your community, what is going on, what needs to be addressed. You have to be knowledgeable. And I think sometimes things are just said for political gain without thought of consequences.
Well, and yeah, no, I completely agree with that. It's for, and the bail issue itself has become, you know, a political football back and forth, and when it really shouldn't be that way. But when you brought up property crimes, and, you know, one of the things that's always struck me about property crimes or failure to prosecute property crimes is that's one of the functions of government, is to provide an environment where people can thrive and where businesses can perform. And you cannot have an open business if anyone can walk in and just take your product. Or you're going to have to essentially create this barred, you know, area where everything's locked up and you can't really shop. You can, it's just going to affect your bottom line. And then your argument is, well, why do I pay taxes? You know, what am I getting out of the government? I'm just going to close this place down, you know, because I can't afford to keep this open. So, you know, that decision making seems like if you're coming from the prosecutor saying, okay, we're not going to charge this, or you know, we're just going to cite and release these people. You know, I think that probably the podcast you were talking about was when we talked to Ken Good. I mean, you know, you're talking about implosion of these areas, particularly inner city areas, which we don't really have so much here in Johns County. But I'm seeing in Johnson County an uptick in things in crime, and I'm seeing a downtick in keeping people in custody. Douglas County, for instance, has essentially eliminated its bail bond industry. You know, by I just saw this 2 days ago when I was looking at someone who had a detainer here, looking at their Douglas County case because they had a warrant from Douglas County. Well, they failed to appear, but you know, they failed to appear and they gave them a signature bond on the warrant. Mm-hmm. What was the point of that?
And, you know, what I'll say about property crimes, too, as well, is, you know, Johnson County is starting a drug court here. It's a specialty court. And when you listen to the presentations, and from my own experience, a lot of property crimes are fueled by drug abuse. And, you know, those property crimes are committed in order to get money to buy drugs. So that's how, you know, the judge that's in charge of the drug court talks about a lot of these cases, is these property crimes get people into the specialty court to help them address the root issue of what's occurring. So again, when you make, you know, blanket policy decisions, you may be missing the why of it, right? And the opportunities to help people, to get them into drug treatment and to stop the behavior.
Well, this book that's behind me, What's Killing America by Jason Rantz, just came out. He talks about that, and this is relates to drugs. You know, people will sit there and claim, well, the war on drugs has failed. You know, well, yes and no, but has it really? I mean, you know, one of the points that's there is people who use drugs can't hold jobs. You know, drugs are still not free, whether they're legal or not, they're still not free. So you've got to get those things. And so at the very base level, if you're stealing stuff to pay for your drug addiction, not to mention all the downstream crime that comes from that, because, you know, you're not always, you know, the most stable person in the world when you're on drugs, too. And so violent crimes come out of that. There's arguments that some of these drugs cause different forms of psychoses that then lead to more violent crime and unsafe, you know, safety in the community. I guess what is your thoughts or policy on drug decriminalization or legalization or the war on drugs itself? You sort of touched on that, but if you could enlighten us.
I think Johnson County is taking a step in the right direction. We're finally getting a drug court. You know, we have been surrounded by jurisdictions that have drug courts to address these issues. And it's now 2023 and it's just occurring. So we were far behind the times. But, you know, I have several clients who have drug addictions, and it can be challenging to get them into drug treatment, to find ways to address the behavior. And it leads to a lot of bond violations, as you know, sure. And they're coming in and out of the court system. So I think it's important to address the drug issues, especially now with fentanyl, you know, all the different deaths we're seeing related to that, you know, to address these issues. You know, the drug possession cases are controlled by the legislature. A lot of them are going to be probation type cases, mandatory treatment. Those are the lower level cases where, you know, we can hope to get in and have intervention. And then we have the drug distribution cases, and those need to be, you know, addressed I think at a more rigorous level when we have individuals who are, you know, dealing these drugs. Not to say that drug possession is okay, because I've had several clients whose lives have, you know, just gone south because of their continued drug usage. And it's not just the client, it's the family. You know, it affects the community. So whether it's the parents or the kids and, you know, what's occurring in the household, we can't act like there's not a drug problem. There is a drug problem and it needs to be addressed. One of my hopes is that, you know, there would be a uniform plea policy in the DA's office on possession of marijuana, because those are all over the board and it's hard to explain to clients why somebody has a probation while others are just fined and released. So again, I'm a big proponent of equal justice. It's important to try to have as much uniformity as you can.
Well, and I'll get back to this marijuana thing just on a touch, because I kind of want to go to the drug thing a little bit more. But on the marijuana thing, I've noticed here of late, particularly since Kansas, Missouri essentially decriminalized and then have an American medical marijuana regimen there as well, it just seems like the people who are, the people who are getting arrested for marijuana at the district court level, I mean, it's simple possession, and they spend the night in jail and they see the judge the next day and get a bond set. But it is always, I mean, 99% of the time, those are signature bonds, which is fine, with the exception that, well, this person is from Texas. They're just passing through. So, I mean, what was the point of even making this arrest? Because maybe they'll come back, but the odds are you're just letting this person from out of state go. I mean, we have these calls from people that were, well, I was just on my way from Colorado to Ohio. Well, I'm sorry. You know, I need somebody locally here to help guarantee your bond. And then they go to court and the court's like, oh, you can sign yourself out. That doesn't seem like an individualized determination.
Right. I have a lot of college kids who get arrested, you know, on K-10 going back from, you know, 4th KU, Johnson County, or going south to colleges. So I have a lot of 19 and 20 year olds who may have a medical marijuana license in Missouri, may have lawfully purchased it, but then they're caught in Kansas. So it's an interesting observation.
Well, on the drug court, I know you had referenced some of the podcasts we've done with Ken Good, but Ken had talked about how the criminal justice system is often the poor man's rehab. And I've had this conversation with clients and families and stuff. And, you know, you call my mom, and mom's like, I'm not getting him out. If I get him out, he's just going to go get high again. You know, and I've had multiple people, you know, just decline to become involved, not because they didn't have the money, not because they couldn't, not because there's any financial difficulty in posting the bond. They just weren't getting that person out because they knew that person was going to go back to that same behavior if they got out. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, they go in front of the judge and the judge gives them a signature bond and they're back out doing the exact same thing again. So, I mean, I guess that's an argument for the possession charges, in that it does, you know, the drug court itself, but it does give the courts and the system some degree of control or some degree of influence over your behavior. I mean, because a lot of this stuff that we do, we're not sitting here locking up people, you know, for possession charges, but we are trying to influence their behavior to get them, you know, to give a hammer, I guess, a negative reinforcement to get away from that particular behavior.
No, and what I would say, a lot of my clients and a lot of people that I prosecuted, what it comes down to is when they decide to stop is going to be when they stop. And a lot of times that's when they hit rock bottom. And I have a lot of family members who will, you know, bond clients out, even they know the behavior is going to continue. And what I often say is by the time you get into the criminal justice system, many things have failed, you know, prior to this. But, you know, to say that we can force drug treatment, you know, I've had a lot of clients, and as a prosecutor, too, go through the therapeutic community, which is a 6-month inpatient treatment program here in Johnson County. And I had, when I was a prosecutor, I had defendants tell me, well, that's where I learned how to get my drug hookups when I was going to get out of the therapeutic community. And then I've had other, you know, people that I've prosecuted and clients say, no, it made a huge difference in my life, you know. So it comes down to when that individual person decides to stop and, you know, what what tools can be given to them through the community and through probation to help them stop. Because sitting in jail, what I find is my clients will sober up and dry out. But if they don't have the tools, because eventually you're going to get out, right? Unless you commit some type of, you know, high level violent, crime, you're going to get out, and you've got to get the mechanisms in place, the coping mechanisms, to try and help combat that drug usage. And I don't know what the formula is. You know, I've seen clients do very well, with the tools they've learned through drug abuse classes on probation. And then I've seen others that just, completely fail.
One of the books behind me is Thinking About Crime by James Q. Wilson. And one of the things that he talks about in there is that the two best methods for deterring crime are the likelihood of getting caught and the swiftness and certainty of punishment. That's for all kinds of criminal activity, not just drugs or property crime or anything else. So talk to us about what you think, how prosecutorial choices affect the overall deterrence that we're able to provide in a criminal justice system.
Well, you mentioned that the second point was the timeliness. And I think that is huge, because we have many cases that sit in the district attorney's office. And I see this from a defense perspective, that are not charged for 6 months to over a year. And that type of delay in charging, it's not safe for the community. And then it's not a deterrent to the person that's committing the crimes. So the quicker the criminal justice system can get involved, and whether that's, you know, bond conditions that may require a mental health examination or a substance abuse evaluation. In my practice, a lot of times once charging is so far down the line from when something occurred that we get them into treatment. So there's not that delay. So it's very important that justice happens swiftly, right? Especially for the victims of the crimes. And as far as the prosecutorial role in charging, tell me again, what was the first point? What was the question? Sorry.
The likelihood of getting caught. So that would be the police response, and the swiftness and certainty of punishment.
Right. No, I agree that it's with anything. If you think you're going to get caught, no matter what it is, maybe that will deter the behavior.
Right.
But you have, there's some types of crimes, I think of domestic violence, that it's not being reported. And that's why we try to encourage people to report, right? Because if you're allowed to continue that conduct, it's not going to stop. And the same with the drug usage and the drug distribution. If it's allowed to continue, it's not going to stop. And I know that sounds very simplistic, but again, I just go back to the timeliness when the crimes occur as to when it's going to be charged. I think that is key in the criminal justice system. You can't let somebody wait a year and a half to be charged and think that that's safe for our community.
Well, and we have two points there. One, simple isn't always bad. Sometimes simple solutions are the best solutions there. They're easy to understand. You've done this. This is the consequence. It's very simple. There's a linear connection between A and B. The other one is the length of time between charging. I mean, we see this happen all the time on various charges where, you send drugs off for testing and then the case doesn't get charged for 6-8 months, or you have some sort of like a felony DUI. That then gets charged, was charged as a misdemeanor initially, and then gets bumped up to the state level as charged as a felony. But 6-8 months later, that charge comes to pass. And now we have to be on house arrest with some sort of alcohol monitor. It's like, what about the last 6 months? Where was public safety there?
Right. And that's why I talk about the delay in charging. And it may not just be waiting for a lab test to determine the blood alcohol content. It could be that it's just sitting on the prosecutor's desk. So it's important to target the types of crimes that need to be given the most attention. A lot of the crimes that I see sitting are special victims unit crimes. Children have been sexually assaulted, child pornography cases. They're just sitting. And it is ridiculous to believe that the behavior is going to stop.
Well, so, and oftentimes, without any impediment from the criminal justice system. That behavior not only is not going to stop, it's going to increase in severity. I mean, domestic violence generally doesn't get better over time.
No, it does not.
I mean, that was one of the arguments for a specialized domestic violence court here, was that, you know, we would have early intervention on these types of charges, you know, to prevent these domestic violence murders and other things down the road. Okay, so let's talk about bail reform just a little bit. This is a Bail Bond podcast, so we should probably touch on a little bit. Generally, when we talk about bail reform, what we're talking about is a move away from any sort of financially secured pretrial release. There's an argument there that, you know, this is just unfair, that, you know, people of means will get out and people without means won't. I think that's probably, as we talked about simplicity, I think that's a little too simple, because that's generally not the way it works. You don't just go, I've got $20 in my pocket so I can get out. Generally, as in a bail situation, financially secured bail, you have to enlist the support of other members of the community. You have to get your friends, your family, your coworkers, some other people involved to come take accountability for you, which is one of the reasons why I think it works. But what are your thoughts on the role of unsecured release in these spiking crime rates that we're seeing in these areas that have gone to these zero bail policies?
Well, you know, we don't have that in Johnson County. You know, there are PR bonds, but there's not zero bond policies. But what I would say about bond is it's so subjective. And it's, you know, the prosecutor makes a recommendation and to a judge. And, you know, there's not a lot of information known at that time, other than the level of the crime, and a bond is set. And what I see is bonds may start out very high, but then they can be greatly decreased, as we have seen in some of the cases that we have worked. But I can tell you for my clients, bond can be important, especially when it comes to monitoring drug usage. I have clients that if they know they're going to be monitored, they're not using.
Right.
And I have had clients that have been removed from, say, pretrial supervision or house arrest. And then especially in the beginning stages, where that gets removed and then the behavior starts again. So, you know, when it comes, and Johnson County has a very robust house arrest program and pretrial services. And I would say that's beneficial to my clients in some cases, but also to the community, you know, especially in DUI cases. And I can't imagine a scenario where you would have a signature bond with no conditions on a DUI case. But those are some of the most important public safety cases that we have, right? We need to make sure that there are conditions in place where things, you know, that they're absolutely being monitored.
Well, and this is, you know, a side story here. I believe my former stepfather may have actually made it into a training video that the Johnson County District Attorney's Office uses for DUIs. That former it wasn't stepfather, it was basically my mother's husband for a time, but he had a severe alcohol problem. But he could control that when he chose. You know, he spent lots of time on house arrest, lots of time on alcohol monitoring. But I recall distinctly, you know, he finished his house arrest, his alcohol monitoring, and he dropped off the equipment. And on the way back home, he stopped and got some at the liquor store to get things up. Right. So it wasn't that, oh, I couldn't stop if I didn't want to. It's just, I don't want to, you know, and when this hammer is hanging over my head, I can stop. Now, One of the arguments against bond is, you know, is the same, and you've mentioned it before, people are going to get out eventually. And so that I know that a number of career prosecutors, the Chris Christies of the world, often warm up to the idea of preventive detention. It's what's used at the federal level in large measure. I mean, if you've listened to some of these podcasts, we've talked about how it used to be that, you know, 75% of people in the federal level got out on some sort of pretrial release. Mm-hmm. When preventive detention became an option under the Bail Reform Act in 1984, that number has flipped on its head. 75% of people remain in custody for the duration of their charges at the federal level. I'm curious about your thoughts of the use of preventive detention, especially now that you've kind of seen this issue from both sides, from both the prosecutorial side and the defense side.
Yeah, it's interesting as a prosecutor, you know, you see the facts in the report, the criminal history, and then when you get on the defense side, you find so much more about what is going on, what has led us to be here. And, you know, I have clients that I believe need to stay in custody, not only for the community safety, but for their own protection. And then I have other clients who need treatment, whether it's mental health treatment or drug treatment, and then I'm an advocate with the judges to, like, let's decrease the bond, but let's set bond conditions to help this individual. And if they don't meet those bond conditions, we know where they're going to end up, right?
Right.
But it's really, and I sound like a broken record, but it is a case by case basis. Not with the high level, you know, violent crime. We know that for the community safety, people need to stay incarcerated. It's when you get down to the lower level that I don't think you can make blanket assertions about what should occur.
Well, there's a huge middle ground. I think we can all agree, you know, the murderers and rapists, you know, they're going to, if they don't remain in custody pending trial, they're going to need really serious, you know, conditions or bond amounts or something, right, that if essentially work as, you know, preventing them from getting out. And then there's all the people that, you know, don't really have any sort of criminal record. And okay, we can let these people go. But there's this large area in the middle, people who have priors, people who've been in trouble before. Maybe they're not serious priors, but they're repeat offenders. They're coming back into the system. How do we deal with those people? And if we just, you know, snap our fingers and kick them back out, well, then we get this over again. If we lock them up, there's downsides to that as well.
Right. Right. No, there's no perfect answer. And I have clients and I will tell them, look, you need to stay in custody. You are not doing well on bond. You know, not only do you risk hurting, you know, others, you know, you are not doing what you need to do to get the treatment, and you end up with new charges. And we have even a bigger hole than when we started, you know. And then I have other individuals who may be charged with higher level offenses that really would benefit from services in the community and should, in my, you know, position is that they shouldn't be incarcerated. And part of that too is, you know, we've suspended statutory speedy trial in Kansas. It's going to come back into play in March of 2024. So there's a longer delay from charging to when this trial or disposition may occur. And oftentimes what I tell clients is, look, if you get out on bond and you do well, that is going to help you at sentencing. And that could be the difference between going to prison versus being out in our community. So there's lots of carrots like you talk about, but you will see that I am, you know, we evolve, right? I'm sure when I started as a prosecutor, it was jail, 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 felony, felony, felony. And as I have evolved and tried higher level, you know, cases, you come to see that you need to try to get services to help people. And ultimately, it may fail and they may end up incarcerated. I've had clients where I thought this is going well, drug treatment's going well, and next thing I know, I see them on the first appearance list. So, but I think it's important that we advocate for treatment, realizing that sometimes it's just not going to work. And people will end up incarcerated for the length of their criminal case from charging to disposition.
Right. Well, let's go back to, well, let me just touch on the drug thing one last time here. You know, the What's Killing America book, Jason Rance talks about, you know, one of the decriminalization strategies in the Pacific Northwest was to try and follow the Portuguese model. You know, the idea that we're, you know, yes, we may, you know, charge you or give you a ticket, but we're going to force you to go into treatment. And if you don't go into treatment, well, then the incarceral option becomes a factor. But what was happening in Pacific Northwest was, yeah, they made that threat, but they weren't actually following up on it. I think his argument was that they'd issued 3,500 citations for these drug possession charges where people were required to come in and report and start getting into a treatment program, and only, I mean, less than a dozen had actually followed up on that. They just said, you know, hey, nice piece of paper, thanks a lot.
Right. You have to have the treatment program available.
Right.
You know, I have a lot of clients who cannot afford the evaluation fee, you know, let alone the treatment program. So if that's a requirement, we have to have something in place.
I guess then it becomes a question of funding. One of the issues you brought up there as far as speedy trial and the ability to get people charged quickly is an issue of being able to have a well-funded district attorney's office. I mean, Johns County is not as bad as other places.
Right.
I mean, I'm familiar in my role in the KBAA, I'm familiar with kind of what's going on in Sedgwick County as well. Sedgwick County routinely does what they call whopping out, or basically, you know, release without prejudice. In other words, you're booked in and you spend, you know, that 48 hours in custody. At the end of that 48 hours, we don't have you charged. You're out the door. Now, they have a pre-bond sort of thing that that Johns County never adopted, that you can, you know, post bond and get out on that.
Yes.
But that's, you know, one of the things I've always liked about Johns County is that, hey, you know, we arrest you and we can, if you arrest you on a probable cause basis, you're either going to get charged or going to get let go. Now, sometimes you get let go and charged later on, but not every county is like that. And that's, that's a funding issue.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I say that justice is geographical. You know, since I've been a defense attorney, I travel to a lot of different jurisdictions. And, you know, in Johnson County, if you're arrested, a charging decision is going to be made within 48 hours. Whereas in other jurisdictions, there could be a probable cause finding and no bond set. And you could sit there for, we had a client sit for almost a month before he was charged. But those jurisdictions, it's interesting to me that you're arrested, you're not charged with a crime, but you have to post bond. I had a family member in Douglas County that went through that. He was not charged, but he had to post bond and then just show up to court every 30 days to wait to see when they would be charged. You know, and in the meantime, he's getting into more trouble.
Right.
So again, it goes back to timely charging, but we are very lucky in Johnson County. Our DA's office is very well funded. You know, I go to other jurisdictions where they can't hire prosecutors because the pay is so low. You know, we have a crime lab in Johnson County that is very robust and have, you know, just an incredible capacity on our cases. Other jurisdictions are not so lucky. So no, I completely agree. And it goes back to justice is geographical, depending upon where you land. And that makes a huge difference in bonds, right? A
sure.
bond in Western Kansas, where everybody knows the person in that community, is going to be very different from, you know, here in Johnson County, where they may have been a member of the Johnson County community, you know, all of their life. But it's different. Justice is geographical.
Well, and there's a different focus on some of the, you know, in like on the I-70 corridor, you may have these people that are, you know, have drugs, get caught running, coming out of Colorado with marijuana, you know, pounds of marijuana. Those bonds are going to be significantly higher in Western Kansas than they might be if you're caught here, just because, you know, it's a larger area. So let's talk about misdemeanor cases just a little bit. You know, we'd mentioned that before. You know, we don't want to walk away from misdemeanor cases. Ken Good, who I refer to a lot because he does another podcast on bail-related stuff, said that misdemeanor cases were often the training ground for future felons. And if you train people that it's okay to commit misdemeanors, then ultimately you'll end up with more felonies because those people, you know, just like, you know, domestic violence doesn't get better over time, it gets worse.
Right.
Criminal activity tends to get better over time, up to a point. People do tend to age out of criminal behavior, but up to a point, it just gets progressively worse. Given that in a county like Johnson County, with several large cities and multiple municipal courts and police departments, all of whom have their own policies and procedures, for all practical purposes, you know, no one in charge in municipal court is actually required to post bond anymore. So you don't have that deal. I mean, you know, we only post bonds at a municipal court at this point when somebody's already missed court. And then maybe not even then, they might circle back out again in just a few hours. How does the district attorney ensure that all these municipal courts are doing their jobs?
Well, we're going to talk about this later, but I am actually going to be running for district attorney here in Johnson County in 2024. And one of the things that I want to institute is, you know, a more robust communication between municipal prosecutors and the district attorney's office and expand that out. I also want to include Wyandotte County, Jackson County, you know, Douglas County, all the counties, Miami counties that surround us. But there need to be discussions, especially like DUIs. You know, trying to figure out as quickly as they can, is this a misdemeanor or is this a felony? And having a coordinated effort. There used to be that. I'm not seeing that as much anymore. Same thing with theft cases. You know, you're those aggregate to felony level. But we need to have more uniform policies and discussions.
I'll get into that. I've got one more question about that. Then actually, I'll just lead to this one. So as voters, if our goal is to have a safe community, what should we be looking for when we select a candidate for district attorney?
Well, experience.
Right.
I think it's important to have walked the walk to be in this. I've been, you know, a prosecutor for over 21 years, but also another advantage I have is I've been on the defense side. And I think to have, you know, the best overall view of the criminal justice system, you need to have been on both sides. And I have prosecuted high level, everything from high level violent offenses to where, you know, I had to have protection for myself and my family, down to, you know, misdemeanor drug crimes, speeding tickets. And, you know, my goal is always, number one, is to protect the community. But then also, what can we do so this individual is not going to be back here again, right? One of the things that is missing from the DA's office are these specialized units. The office was reorganized in 2020, and they will tell you that these units still exist, you know, sex prosecution, white collar, drug units, but they don't based upon how the district attorney's office functions. And I think in order to best serve our community, you have to have these prosecutors who are experts in child abuse cases, you know, in domestic violence cases to protect our community. And I feel like right now our DA's office is more of a factory, just in and out, in and out. And that's not how it should be. And I think there should be more transparency. If I become DA's office, if I become the district attorney, on our DA website, we're going to have statistics. You know, what crimes are being committed? What crimes are being prosecuted? What are the dispositions? How many are going to jury trial? What is being no charged? Because the community needs to know what is occurring within the DA's office. And that transparency is just not there.
Well, I mean, the current DA is not you know, nearly what I would call a progressive prosecutor. I think we if we're looking for local areas, I think we can just look north of us and get that sort of reaction where there's not good cooperation between the DA's office and the police. And the police don't feel that they have right. someone with who's supporting them in the prosecutor's office in that county. Aside from the specialized units, since we are talking politics, what would you do right. differently than what the current office is doing? Other than, you know, just here's some transparency. And we'll have these specialized units.
Right. And it's interesting being on the defense side, you know, I didn't see all of this when I was in the office. But one thing I've noticed is how cases are being handed off from prosecutor to prosecutor. I have cases that are on their third or fourth prosecutor. You know, how is that justice for that victim? You know, how is there a continuity in prosecution for that case? You know, the delay in charging, and I've talked about that before, but to me, that is a huge issue. We can not have high-level felonies sitting on prosecutors' desks that are not being charged. So we would definitely institute policies that would require review. If a rape case is on a prosecutor's desk for over 30 days, we need to look at that and find out why. Does it need to be sent back to the police department for further investigation, or is it just sitting there because the prosecutor is busy, you know, maybe doing a different type of crime? Right. It's interesting. When I was after that reorganization, I had homicide cases, I had child sex cases, but I was spending a lot of time, you know, working on motions to suppress for misdemeanor drug stop cases on K-10. It was not a good allocation of resources. You know, when I was in that office, I looked at my mentors. You will see many of them now are judges, are very successful defense attorneys. Right. And what happened within the last 5 years or so, we have had numerous experienced prosecutors leave that office for various reasons. And what I see is the training is not occurring with the new prosecutors. You know, you can't just give somebody a notebook and say, hey, this is how you're a prosecutor. You need to have mentoring programs. You know, you need to have attorneys sitting with the younger attorneys and teaching them how to prosecute. You know, I would learn by sitting in court and watching, but most importantly, having somebody mentor me. So I know it's difficult to recruit prosecutors right now. You just need to look at all the different prosecutorial offices around and at all the openings. But the prosecutors that we have, we need to do better. We need to train them. Also, I will say we need to rebuild relationships with law enforcement. You know, what I constantly hear is prosecutors won't return my calls. Prosecutors won't return my emails. How do you successfully prosecute a case when you're not working with your case detective, when you're not working with your law enforcement? That is, justice is not going to happen when we walk into a courtroom unprepared.
Well, I mean, and trial by fire, I guess, works over time. But in the meantime, how many lost cases and how much right. damage has been done in the meantime if you're not putting people in positions yeah. where they can be successful?
Yeah, I don't like the trial by fire. I do not like that. I mean, maybe in lower level, like traffic court, speeding tickets, things like this. I'm just sure. speaking off the cuff. But, you know, what I see is a lot of younger prosecutors that are trying specialty high level cases that don't have that experience and they don't have somebody sitting with them. And that is not how it should be. That is not protect our community. And that leads to a lot of, you know, you start to look at jury trial stats. There have been a lot of not guilty jury verdicts. Or if you look at plea dispositions and see what's happening. So there has to be better training in that office.
Well, and just spitballing here, and this is just throwing this out here, but I know we've looked at this in other professions, like in the medical profession, you know, trying to get doctors into rural areas. Is there something that could be done at the state level, particularly, as you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, right. law school's not cheap. You know, is there some way to get a service type component to get people in to serve a few years as a prosecutor and the state level for some sort of student debt forgiveness?
They do have that. They do have that. So I did not have that. I was too old for that. But several of the prosecutors that I supervised, I think it's 10 years. And if it's 10 years in community service, then your debt is wiped out, which is huge.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
My student loan payment, I think I started as a prosecutor at like $40,000 and my student loan payments were like $600 to $700 a month.
Boy,
living in Johnson County, that is very difficult. So that's why a lot of my classmates would go to civil firms and could make so much money. But, you know, to me, being a prosecutor is where you can best help your community. You're not going to make a lot of money doing it, but you can go home at night and feel good about what you've done.
Well, and I've said in several podcasts that I think that the criminal justice system is one of the pillars upon which a society is built. If you don't have people, you know, constantly, you know, watering that tree of justice, not with blood, but I mean, with justice, you know, you're going to have societal breakdown. So as a final question, we'll wrap this up here and let you get back to work. All of us who work in the criminal justice system have to be mindful that the work can have a negative impact on us. You know, we might refer to a case as just a domestic battery, as mm-hmm. in your family history, because we see these cases regularly.
Right.
Almost a couple thousand of them come through every year, and that's just domestic battery. But the impact of that case on the victim can be mm-hmm. life altering. So how do you personally avoid becoming jaded and hardened from working in this system?
Right. It's funny. You said I wrote down jaded. Because that's exactly what happens. And I think that can skew prosecutorial viewpoints because they become so jaded, you know, oh, they're just going to reoffend or, you know, this is just going to happen again. But my energy, and I will be honest, there are times when I go home and I'm like, I don't know if I can do this anymore, especially as a defense counsel. I feel like I'm, you know, 50% attorney, but then 50% mental health counselor, you know, trying to work through this, you know, and at the end of the day, it's, you know, I hope that I have enough strength for the next day to help people. And, you know, you have to have different things in your life, whether it's family, exercise, you know, faith, things like that, that help get you through that. But becoming jaded is one of the worst enemies of a prosecutor. Also, ego. I would talk to a lot of the prosecutors that I mentored and that, you know, having a big ego is one of your worst enemies in the courtroom. Because you tend to overlook and not prepare. But, you know, there are times when I am jaded, but you have to remember that each case matters. And I think I look back at my childhood and remember it's not just domestic violence. You know, these are, they have long-term effects. And we have to be mindful of that. And we can't just throw away people, say, oh, they've been using drugs for 20 years. There's nothing we can do. No, if that's your attitude, then maybe you shouldn't be sitting in that prosecutorial chair because we have to keep moving forward. And, you know, my big thing every day is, you know, I want to help people. And I know that sounds simplistic, but really, isn't that what we're here for? To help each other through this.
Absolutely.
And the criminal justice system, in my view, is the best way I can do that. I couldn't be a doctor. I don't like, you know, all the blood and the gore, you know. But I think we have a special opportunity in the criminal justice system, protect our community to, you know, to help individuals. When most people that I meet, they are in their lowest point in their life. You know, they've just been arrested. They're charged with these crimes. There may be circumstances that are going to help them down the line, maybe to lessen it, maybe to get the case dismissed. But at the very beginning, that's not where you're at. So you meet folks at the worst time of their life, and you have to just day by day, you know, figure out, okay, this is how you're going to cope with this. This is what we're going to do, whether it's evaluations or treatment. And if you can help one person through that, my opinion is, well, that's one less victim down the road, right?
Right.
If you can help somebody, you know, individuals with DUIs, I talk about evolving and, you know, part of the domestic violence problem in my childhood was alcohol. And, you know, you look at that and you're like, okay, if we can address what is the root problem of this alcoholism, right?
Right.
Then maybe we can make a change. So, again, it's, you know, my goal is to try to figure out what can we do, to make things better, to help people to move forward and get out of the criminal justice system.
Well, I have this conversation with parents all the time. It's like, you know, what we need to figure out now is how do we move forward to put this behind you in a manner that lets right. you continue on with your life as best as possible, you know, not to go back and do these things again, but to move forward on this. So it's
right. And I think, you know, that, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to talk about that's where expungement is key. You know, when after you go to a sentencing, the judge in Kansas will tell you, you have a right to expungement. But I think a lot of people don't understand that. It's not properly explained. So, you know, I talk to my clients about, you know, whatever the time frame is for that particular crime is you want to attempt to get this expunged. So when your criminal history, like if you're applying for a job, that it doesn't appear. Now, we know in some criminal, more extensive criminal background checks, it's going to appear. But on a job application, if you have that conviction expunged, you can put that you've not been arrested. So that's a way to move on as well, because we all make mistakes, right? There was probably plenty of things I did when I was a teenager and in college that I could have been in trouble for, you know, and the goal is to be able to help people to move past that.
And we did do a podcast on expungement as well. If you want to go back and kind of look at our past episodes, I think it was Joy Springfield, you know, out of Topeka on that. And she does do expungement festivals across the state. Actually, I think there's one coming up in Johns County here.
You know, it's $195 in court costs was one that I recently did. That's a lot of money for some folks to be able to do that. So.
And I think there's some waivers in there that you get it in certain circumstances as
right.
well. Okay. So. Maybe going to be a new DA here in a year and a half or so. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. Hopefully everyone has a new insight on the role of the prosecutor and the importance of local prosecutor, I guess, in avoiding societal collapse, but, you know, in moving us forward as a society. We will put a link, if you want to get that over to us, to your campaign at the end of the podcast here. So people have to actually listen to us talk before they get that link,
right.
or they can just skip to the end. But thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. I really do appreciate it, Vanessa.
You're very welcome. Have a good day. Thank you.
We again want to thank our guest, Vanessa Riebley, for talking with us today. Hopefully everyone has a new insight on the role and importance of your local prosecutor in avoiding societal collapse and making sure that the society functions. Please check out her link if you're interested in supporting her for district attorney. And we hope that you will join us for the next episode of the Bail in the Midwest podcast.
For more information about Vanessa Riebley, please visit her on the web at riebleyforda.com. That's R-I-E-B-L-I-F-O-R-D-A. Join us again next time for the Bail in the Midwest podcast, hosted by Shane Rolfe.